Over the month of November, as I mentioned last week, we're going to look at the four main challenges to believing in God that modern people face. And I don't expect all of you to face all four of them. Maybe you don't experience any of them, but there's certainly challenges that people have today. And those four problems that people face are the evidence for the existence of God, and in essence, prove to me that God exists. The problem of evil, why an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God can allow so much pain and suffering in life. The conflict between religion and science. There seems to be a basic division between religion and science, but especially when it comes to human origins. You know, where did we come from? What is the source of our existence? What is the purpose behind our existence? And then the last of the four major challenges that modern people face, people 500 years ago didn't face this problem, but we do today, is the multiplicity of religions. We live, especially in Canada, in a multicultural, multiracial, multi-religious society today. And that has many blessings too, but it also brings into interactions with each other many faith positions. And that confuses people. Like, if there is a God, wouldn't God be more clear about what God's intentions were in life, what God wanted from us, or how God wanted us to worship, for instance? And so the very existence of so many different religious perspectives is a challenge for anyone who holds a religious point of view, not just Christians. It's a unique aspect of our culture, because when I grew up as a kid, the main division was between Catholics and Protestants. We're all Christians, we just didn't have exactly the same take on things. But now, there's a multiplicity of religions in our communities. And that generally means that the challenge of religion grows when there's more religions at play with each other. In some respects, it's not unlike what the early church faced when they went out into the Roman Empire. Now, we started last week with the problem of evil because of Remembrance Sunday, what it represents. Because Remembrance Day is essentially about confronting evil in the world and how far we should be prepared to go in confronting evil. And of course, the call in that day is to go the whole way, to risk our lives if necessary, to confront evil in life. And so we honor those who did go the whole way in their journey to confronting evil with giving up their lives. And that's what Remembrance Day is really about. Today, the presence of evil is probably the major barrier to belief in God. Most people who struggle with belief in God struggle around things like pediatric cancer, you know, killer viruses, things like the Holocaust, the chronic proliferation of war through history. In the face of an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God, these two claims, the presence of evil that we know and this all-powerful, all-knowing, loving God, seem to contradict each other. And we talked last week about how our Christian faith attempts to address the potential contradiction. Today we're looking at the challenge posed by the type of evidence available us to use in our claims that God exists. Like, what are the proofs available to us? And I think it's important that before we go down the path of evidence, and it's going to be a two-part series today and next Sunday looking at this, I think it's important to say that it's completely satisfactory to come to a life of belief and faith in God through the witness of the Holy Spirit. You don't need to have external evidence. You don't have to have it. I think the evidence of the witness of the Spirit in our hearts is sufficient. If you come to a knowledge of God through the blessing of the Holy Spirit in your lives, well, good for you. I think most people come to a faith in life through the witness of the Spirit or the witness of other people. That's the primary mode for evangelism for the last 2,000 years for Christianity. One person has a God experience or an experience with the risen Lord. A revelatory experience has been given to them, and they share it with other people. That's how most people come to know God in life, through the witness of other people. And that should not be surprising to us, because that's true in life generally speaking. Word of mouth, as we know, is by far the best form of advertising. If people love your product or service, and they enthusiastically share it with others, there is your marketing campaign. Costco does not spend a cent on advertising for new customers. Did you know that? You'll never see a Costco ad in the newspaper or on the radio on television. You'll never see a flyer of Costco intended to get new customers. They rely on word-of-mouth enthusiasm of their members to go out and promote them. This is a form of witnessing, a type of testimony. Small businesses today rise or fall on the word-of-mouth promotion of their clientele. So if you've had a revelation of God in your life, and I would say good for you, you might want to consider sharing it with others. I think some people come to believe in God and come to a life of faith through intuition, too. It just seems right. Most children, did you know, are intuitional theists. Even if their parents are atheists, a four-year-old looks around at the apparent design in life, looks around at the creatures, the flowers, the mountains, they intuit a very natural conclusion. Behind the design in life, there must be a designer who is responsible for the beauty and wonder of life. This is true of most four-year-olds. In fact, you might even say that Psalm 19 that Selma read this morning is the cry of an intuitive believer. This is a common feature in the Psalms, that the created order gives testimony, witness to the Creator. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of His hands. The creation is the evidence for you, God. The sheer majesty of creation declares the existence and the nature of God. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. As the songwriter says in the Bible, they don't say anything. They have no speech. No sound is heard from them, yet nonetheless, their voice goes out to the ends of the earth, which means that they give powerful evidence for the existence of God, for the nature of God. You know, Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, says, it's lovely to live on a raft. We had the sky all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look at them and discuss about whether they were made or only just happened. The heavens sure make you wonder. On a black night out in the country, in a pure, clear sky when you look at the Milky Way. You know, a friend of mine and I went to a show on the Hubble Space Telescope when it came out years and years ago, back in the 90s. We went to a planetarium that had a special show on the Hubble Space Telescope. And we leaned back in our seats and we saw picture after picture projected on the ceiling of the planetarium. This was before the internet really got started. So it was our first experience at seeing those kinds of pictures, photographs. It was an amazing experience, and when we came out, my friend, who was and still is a committed atheist, admitted to me that the picture spoke something very powerful to him, inspired him to a sense of mystery and reverence. For a moment, he was a believer. As beautiful as the sky is a flower any less magnificent? In their exquisite detail, are they not also capable of giving evidence to a mind behind all things? I look at a flower and I see the exquisite design behind them. Do we really think that these flowers were simply the product of random, exclusively naturalistic processes? My four-year-old says no. The four-year-old that lives in me says, not a chance. Or what about birds? I know there's a lot of birders out there, birders in our congregation. They too express a certain exquisite magnificence. That is why there are so many birders out there seeking for them. The biologist Richard Dawkins says that the apparent design in creation, it's an illusion. He argues that it all can be explained through naturalistic processes. No need for God or any other kind of higher process. Dawkins says that Darwin laid out the basic explanation in his Origin of Species, and it works. As they say, my four-year-old in me, who's alive and well, kicking strong, is dubious. I don't think so, he says to me. Do You feel your 4-year-old ever speaking to you like that? I think my 4-year-old intuition is trustworthy. So is yours. Apparent design is real design. Why not? Why isn't that the case? And the presence of real design leads to a natural conclusion that there is a designer. That was what the philosopher William Paley thought. If you see design, the implication is there must be a designer. We'll talk about this more next week, but Darwin did not explain it all. Today, Darwin's hypothesis that all living things arose through the process of natural selection, working on random variation, we would say genetic mutation, the things that we were taught in our grade 11 biology class are running into serious objections in the scientific community. In some ways, we're returning to the great mystery and wonder about how did life really arise on this planet? And what were the mechanisms that gave rise to it? Unless you think that I am a bit crazy about this, the mathematician and astronomer Fred Hoyle said a number of years back, "It is ironic that the scientific facts throw Darwin out, but leave William Paley," he's the one that believed that design leads to the designer, "a figure of fun to the scientific world for more than a century, still in the tournament with a chance of being the ultimate winner. Indeed, such a theory is so obvious that one wonders why it is not widely accepted as being self-evident. The reasons are psychological rather than scientific." You might say also philosophical. He also says in another quote a few years later, "The chance that higher life forms might have emerged through evolutionary processes is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the material therein." Now, it's important to note that Hoyle was an atheist. At the end of his life, he started toying with theism a little bit, but he was an atheist. And this is his thinking about this all. Theism is the belief in God. You are a theist if you believe in a higher power, usually an all-loving, all-knowing, all-powerful God, but it doesn't have to be that characteristics, those characteristics, but usually an all-loving, all-knowing, all-powerful God. Is there and are there good reasons for belief in such a God? Independent of revelation that is important to us, and independent of our 4-year-old intuition, is there good evidence for this kind of belief? If there is good evidence, then you're considered to be a rational theist. If you can find evidence that supports your view beyond your own subjective experiences, then you're a rational theist. If the evidence is all weighed against you, against the belief in God, as many scientists today suggest, like Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins, if you keep on believing that, and against all the evidence out there, all the mounting evidence to the contrary, then you're called an irrational theist. And today, I think many Christians have been bullied into believing that belief in God is an irrational act. Do you ever get that feeling at all? I think people are a bit shy about sharing their beliefs with other people because they don't want other people to think that they're nuts. Is Trillium made up of a bunch of irrational theists? I think we've been conditioned by our culture to instinctively believe this about things. The evidence we've been told is all lined up against our belief in God. We have to lean in against the evidence to keep believing. And if there's one characteristic that modern people don't want to appear as, don't want to be labeled as, it is irrational. It can be labeled many things, but irrational, I think we all shy away from that. I don't want to appear as a freak for believing in God. Do you? I don't want to be a part of that flaky fringe way over there that our society seems to have relegated people of faith to. As I say, I think that's why so many of us are muted in the sharing of our faith with others. Not just evangelists, but just even acknowledging that we go to church someplace or that we believe in God. Are you a part of an irrational group of believers today? Do you still believe in God? Some people might have thought that those ideas died out a long time ago in our culture, amongst the elite, the most educated. This is in spite of the fact that the polls today still tell us that most people believe in God. Most people believe in some kind of higher power out there. They don't just accept that everything is physical and naturalistic. Many, many people believe in God. Most scientists, more than 50% of scientists out there believe in God. Even among the members of the National Academy of Science, the most elite scientific organization in North America, still 10 to 15% of their membership believes in God. Are they irrational in their, are they irrational in their belief? Do they believe still in spite of the evidence? There are four great scientific theories of the past 400 years. There's Newton's theory of gravity. There's Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic field. There's Einstein's theory of special and general relativity. And then there's the theory of quantum mechanics. Those are the four great theories of science over the last 400 years. None of them have anything to say about God. None. There's no mention of God in them at all. These theories completely exist independently of any belief in God or any religious claim for or against God either. Any scientist who attempts to use these theories to explain away God is now speaking philosophically, not scientifically. Science has nothing to say directly for or against the belief in God. When Stephen Hawking was saying that there was no longer any need for God, he'd come up with end theory, and he had basically proven that you don't need God anymore to justify the creation of the universe. Well, yeah, he's a smart guy, but understand in that moment he was speaking philosophically and not scientifically. His credentials as a scientist are strong, but they're completely irrelevant to the truth claims about God, which are religious and philosophical in nature. And Stephen Hawking's philosophical thinkings were not part of his strengths. One of his colleagues said to him that he didn't have a philosophical bone in his body. So why are we kowtowed by elite scientists who have philosophical views against the belief in God, but really have nothing to say about it from a scientific point of view? Why do we privilege people like Hawking's views in our culture today, allow them to influence our confidence and our faith when their views are exclusively philosophical and not scientific? And Hawking is no more privileged to speak about the existence of God or the lack of existence of God than you are, or me, for that matter. Science attempts to explain the how of things. Science is really about predicting events, not explaining them. Science can't really answer the why of something. We can acknowledge the universe exists, but why does it exist? As John mentioned to me last week, why is there something instead of nothing? Science can't answer that. Part of the problem I think we face is that some things can't be easily measured. Like, how do you measure love? How would you go about measuring love? How do you prove that love is real? We might be able to detect the effects of love, right? You know, like you're lying in bed sick and your spouse brings a bowl of soup for you. That might be a sign of love. You know, you had some heartache in your life and a friend calls you to cheer you up. Or maybe someone sends you an endearing gift on your birthday. That might be all signs of love. But how do you prove that it's love? How do you know that it's really love behind it all? How could it could be just enlightened self-interest, or perhaps someone is scheming for future advantage with you. How do you prove that it's actually love? Does that make belief in love irrational? I think our four-year-old would say no. Politeness can't be measured. We know politeness when we see it. We know it when we experience it. But you can't measure politeness. Does that make belief in politeness irrational? What about wisdom? You can't really measure wisdom. You can't measure and describe wisdom in a very scientific way. Does that make wisdom irrational? And what about believing? What about believing? Any kind of believing. I'm not just talking about believing in God. Any kind of believing. Like tomorrow morning, is the sun going to rise tomorrow morning? What's your belief about that? What's your faith about that? Is it going to happen? Is that an irrational belief? Because there's no proof that the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning. Just because it happened yesterday doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. What is your justification for believing that the sun is going to rise tomorrow? That the past informs the future? Well, that's a belief. That's not a fact. Our basic thinking in life is rooted in faith. The past patterns extend into the future. We know this from our own experience. Faith is a part of your life, your daily life. You cannot live life without faith. You cannot drive down the road without the faith that you can trust that the person's going to stop at that stop sign you're going by. If you don't believe that, then you can't drive on the streets. You'll go nuts doing it. Every moment will become a point of personal risk. You can't live without faith. Fred Hoyle said in another quote, he said, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics." Now, this is an atheist saying this. A common sense interpretation of the fact suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. We'll look at that in more detail. We'll look at some of what Hoyle is talking about in specific detail next week, but it won't be a scientific journal paper being read out. There is evidence to suggest there is a superintelligence monkeying with forces of physics, biology, and chemistry. It's a reasonable position to take. It won't be absolute proof in the existence of God. You can't prove God any more than you can prove that the sun is going to rise tomorrow from facts. You can intuit from them, though, something of importance. Reason cannot in itself bring someone completely to a relationship to a reality of God in life. We need revelation and we need intuition. But it does mean that our belief in God can be a rational decision, that we can be rational theists rooted in evidence in our beliefs. See, because I don't know about you, but I have no desire to be ultimately an irrational theist. My faith does rest on my God experiences, the sense of the Holy Spirit at work in my life. My faith does rest in some sense that my heart has come to know Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. I know the Lord to some degree, and I want to keep growing in that knowledge. But there's no doubt that my belief also rests on my 4-year-old intuition in the reality of God. That 4-year-old who's still strong and kicking inside me. When I was a kid, God was completely self-evident to me. The idea of God was just something that was self-evident in the way that Hoyle's quote is talking about. From the earliest age, I believed in God. The simplest and most satisfying explanation for all the apparent design in life, in the stars and in the flowers and in the birds and everything else that I came across, was that there was design in life. Not just apparent design, but real design. And if real design, then there must be a designer behind it all. As Hoyle said, indeed, such a theory, the presence of design that infers a designer, is so obvious, he says, that one wonders why it's not widely accepted as being self-evident. The reasons are psychological, philosophical, rather than scientific. There are people out there who just don't want to believe in God. Understand that. I don't know if their disbelief is rational or irrational, but they just don't want to believe. Now, you and I, we live as people of faith. We also live as people of intuition, but we also live as modern, Western-educated people, most of us here. And that means the empirical evidence for us is important. It matters. I don't want to live in my faith life against the evidence, and I suspect that's true for most of you as well. You don't want to be part of that flaky fringe any more than I do. I'm pleased to say to you today, and we'll talk about this more next week, that there is strong and good empirical reasons for belief in God. It means that our belief can rest on a strong foundation of fact. Like a table with four strong legs, for too long we've been told that one of our legs is weak, wobbly, cracked. It won't bear the burden. It will collapse if we put too much pressure on it. This understanding of that leg is not true. Our belief in God rests on a table with four strong legs, and that means it can stand the test of evidence. It means we can bring our heart and our mind together as we rationally embrace a life of faith.